Support for WPR comes from Analog Ice Cream and Coffee, offering handcrafted cookies, coffees, and Wisconsin ice cream in the heart of Sister Bay. More information is available on Facebook and Instagram at Analog SB.
As this fiscal year comes to a close, help set up WPR for another strong year of quality music, news, and entertainment. Give now at WPR.org/donate.
Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at home remodeling and repair today with our guest John Freiberger, registered home inspector, more than 45 years of experience. He specializes in energy design, restoring older homes. Been with us for a long, long time on the show, and it's great to have him back. We're going to zero in a bit to start the show on water damage to your home. We'll take that as far as you want it to go, as a matter of fact. If you've noticed excess moisture somewhere in your home, maybe you have mold in your attic or basement, maybe you have other questions, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. John Freiberger, welcome back.
Very pleased to be back with you, Larry.
All this rain and flooding, I'm sure it's plenty of, you're seeing some damage issues out there.
We're seeing a lot of them, Larry, and I heard something on the news, I can't even remember what program it was, but they said in the old days, when you and I were kids, we get a 2-inch rainfall once a year. Yeah. Now we get them 5 times a year. And in the last, if you look at the last decade, we've had 8, 15, and 16-inch rainfalls in the Madison and surrounding area. That's an awful lot of water.
Yeah. So which areas, of course, if you get that much rain, your basement's going to probably have an issue, but there's probably other parts of the house too.
Well, yeah, location, 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 as they say in real estate, right? You really want to be on top of a hill during climate change.
Yeah.
but what I'm seeing, Larry, you're always going to have things. You have an old concrete block foundation in a flat area in Menominee Falls. Yeah, it's going to leak several times a year. That's sort of expected. Unless you dig up the whole foundation and waterproof it and all of that stuff, that's sort of expected. But what I'm seeing is people building defects into their house, contractors who don't understand. And one of the things I'm getting a lot of is egress windows. I've got multiple problems with people with new houses and with remodeling where they put an egress window in the basement, or in one case, three of them. And in one case, they flooded out 3 bedrooms. The other case, they only flooded out 1 bedroom. So people are either building or are hiring a contractor, they really need to think about egress windows, because what if those gutters overflow because we didn't, clean the maple, those little maple spitty things out, and that water pours into that window well? Where does it go? Well, I find that the windows aren't sealed. So once you get water in the window well, it basically comes into that finished basement room. And generally, you're putting in an egress window because you want to finish a basement room.
Yeah.
So then you've got all of this water behind the drywall. Behind the drywall, we've got cellulose. Cellulose grows mold. And if not completely dried out in 48 hours, we're looking at mold remediation. So people need to think about the depth of the window well. Window well covers. If you have drain tile around your house, can we dig down to the drain tile? So we're putting basically drainage inside the window well. We certainly want the soil for the window well to be at least a foot or 18 inches below the window. Now, we can put in washed stone because washed stone has 40% airspace. But if you're putting clay soil right up to 2 inches of your window well, 2 inches of rain is going to come. As soon as you get 2 inches of rain, it's going to come into your house. So some thinking about design is going to save you a lot of trouble if you're putting an egress window into your existing house or you're building a new house with egress windows.
What about siding?
Well, times are changing, aren't they? You and I have old wood siding on our houses.
Yeah.
I've got a very old house. So I got tar paper behind mine, which doesn't seal well at windows. But wood siding, once you caulked it, and if you flashed above the windows and the doors, the exterior of the siding really acted sort of as a rain barrier. Now, most newer houses, because of cost consideration, people can't afford wood. And besides, wood's in short supply. So we have vinyl siding. Vinyl siding is considered to be what's called a rain screen. So it's like a screen on your window. Some rain gets through it, drains out underneath the screen, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at, if a homeowner looks at their vinyl siding and looks up at the bottom, they're going to see it's got little holes in it. And those are there to drain water out. So if we do not have a good weather-resistant barrier behind that, we are going to take water into our house. And the problems with weather-resistant barriers is the installation and the sealing of them. The windows and doors, we have to seal the edges very, very carefully, and we have to flash above them. When we have the newer sidings, the composite sidings, like the James Hardy Cementus siding, LP has their siding, which is sort of OSB.
Yeah.
Those have to be flashed. And their installation instructions are really quite good. And one time out of 20, I actually see the installation instructions followed. So I've, as I said before, Larry,
yeah,
if you hire Smith Brothers Contracting to reside your house with LP, you go to LP, you download the 20-page instruction bulletin, you print two copies, you hand one to the Smith Brothers, because I know they've never seen it before, and then you show them you've got the other and you're watching them. So it's really a matter of education. I've run into problems where the contractor has come back. I've worked with the contractor, educated the contractor, and the contractor has retrofitted the house. And after retrofitting a house at his own expense, I'm pretty sure that gentleman did the next 200 houses really nicely.
Well, water in the basement. I told you the story about the house that I bought and was assured that there was never water in the basement, and went to bed the first night after unloading a whole bunch of stuff in the basement for later moving to around the house. Rained pretty hard, and I went down in the basement to check on things and stepped into 8 inches of water.
I'm glad your hand wasn't on the light switch when you did that.
I hadn't turned the light switch on. I was kind of around the corner, and I hadn't gotten to it yet.
So. Good.
Which was a good thing.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
Well, everything in the basement mostly went right out to the jug, but I had to actually put in a drain system after in this older home.
Yes.
Around, it was quite a process. Carrying all that concrete from around along the edges, all the way around the edges, carrying it out in 5 gallon buckets.
Yeah, very, very difficult, but it can be done, and the systems work.
And it did work.
Yeah, and the contractors will give you sometimes a 10 or even a 20 year warranty on it, but it has to be done correctly. There are problems with those in some areas. What many of the contractors do is they put almost, it sort of looks like a corrugated piece of plastic or fiberglass along the wall. So if your wall leaks, it runs down the wall, goes past the floor through behind this corrugated thing and into the drain tile. So we've got the perforated drain tile, we've got this corrugated thing, and then we've got radon in the soil. So our house that used to leak water is now leaking radon. So again, when we do these things, we need to talk to the contractor, and the homeowner needs to be educated to say, okay, am I now going to need a radon mitigation system here as well? And if I've got all these perforations, how exactly do I do that? Because I've got perforations running around the entire basement. I can't just put a radon pump on the radon pit, because what about the radon that's coming in at the far end of the house? So these things, there are solutions to everything, but the solutions are often complicated, and we really need to think about them.
John Freiberger, our guest today. Great to have John back as we talk home renovation and repair with him. Questions for him, give us a call. Been talking about water, but we can take other questions as well. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Joan emailed. She's wondering about running the air the air exploded exchanger. I think what's meant here is the air exchanger in the summertime, running your fan. She keeps it on in the winter, mm-hmm. but hasn't done so in the summer. And whether or not to run it when the AC is on, if it's appropriate to run in the summer. Also, what percentage humidity should be indoors.
Yeah, the second part of that's a real important question, Joan, is because we are seeing lots and lots of mold issues in houses. We get stratified air in houses. And so we'll end up with places like, the finished rooms in the basement can be down near the dew point, at least behind the walls. I mean, our soil in Madison's about 56 degrees. You get up to Ashland, it's about 52 degrees. Well, we're getting to the point where if we've got a lot of humidity in the house and it's relatively cool, we can hit the dew point behind finished drywall in the basement. So I advise people to certainly be no higher than 45 and preferably even at 40%. The question on the heat exchanger, the winter works great because we're getting fresh air in our well-sealed house. We can use it in the summer as well because it is still exchanging BTUs. It is going to take some of the heat out of the outside air. It's probably more efficient in the winter than it is in the summer. But we were just talking about radon. And let's say we're in a high radon area and we want to make sure that our air in the house is healthy. So then running the HVAC system completely, including the heat exchanger in the summer, it does make a certain amount of sense.
Very good. Joan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Air exploder. And it was just, that's one of those, I think, where the... the autocorrect or something, instead of air exchanger, you get air exploded changer. Oh, gosh. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. How did you determine if the damage warrants removing drywall or flooring or other building materials?
I'm sorry, say that again, Larry?
If you've got a wet-ish, some problems mm-hmm. with moisture, how do you determine if the damage warrants removing drywall or flooring or other kind of building materials?
Well, water isn't the problem, mold's the problem. And generally, if you have drywall that is wet for 48 hours, you have mold. And I always recommend that you go to a professional. Some of those professionals are professional, some of them are not. So you've got to look at them very carefully. I've seen some terrible mold remediators out there, and I've seen other firms, especially here in Madison, that really do a first-rate job. But if you can see anything, if you can smell anything, you really do not want to expose yourself.
Extinguishers for my fire extinguishers system that I have installed in the house, when a bead broke on the hose and the water came down the walls, we got some mold removal people in, and they were really good.
Mm-hmm.
I was so happy with the job they did, but they were there right away. There was no waiting around until tomorrow to get the work started.
No, that's a really good point, Larry, is they need to get there before it gets really nasty. And the nice thing about the mold remediation industry, the water cleanup industry, is there's been a lot of science. There are a lot of instructional bulletins. And if people can read and you do some minimal training, you can do a really good job for homeowners.
Yeah, my insurance agent gave me a recommendation. He said, go to them.
The insurance agent would certainly know.
Kit in Mount Horeb, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Good morning. I have a porch, and it's got windows on three sides, but they're not thermopane. And the problem is, in the winter, I get a lot of condensation on there. And then when there's a thaw, I've got water all over the floor, which has damaged the floor and so forth. And one of the solutions I tried was I put a opened one of the windows with a hook on it, and then I put a louvered piece in to keep the snow out in that in the space of the window. Mm-hmm. The problem was the wind wanged on the window to the point where it actually cracked along the hinges and so forth. And so I'm trying to figure out a way to keep that room cold to keep the condensation right down.
And Kit, how old is your house in Mount Horeb? I'm sort of assuming this is an older house.
Well, I built it about 30, started building it 30 years ago. The porch is actually about 20 mm-hmm. years old. Yeah.
So it seems that what we've got is we've got both humidity and heat. Well, and the humidity probably driven by the heat going from the inside of your house to the inside of the porch. And then the porch is cold enough that we're getting the condensation. So one thing to look at would be to see if you can tighten up the house. So if you tighten up the house, it's going to save you some money as well. And to really know what's going on in our houses, and you've got a newer house, but I'll tell you, Kit, the science has really changed the last 12, 15 years as far as how we build things, how we tighten them up, how we save on energy, how we control humidity. You may think about talking to a company that can do a depressurization test of your house. And what they do is they basically they have this calibrated fan. They open your front door, put this calibrated fan assembly in. They depressurize the house to 50 pascals. By looking at the monitors, they can tell you exactly how many cubic liters of air are leaking into the house. And then with a smoke candle in the winter with infrared, they can say, Kit, here's what's really leaking. And we could find that all of your windows that face the porch are leaking badly. And if we do some retrofit on those windows, that we can take care of that. So you'll get more bang for your buck if you put a little science behind it. It's going to cost you between $250 and $500 probably to do the testing. But you're in the Madison area, so there's some good and competent people around here. So I would put some science behind it rather than try to come up with sort of a handyman solution.
Yeah, good luck with that, Kit. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Our guest today, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Taking a look at home renovation and repair today with our guest, John Freiberger, a registered home inspector, his business, Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. Great to have him back with us. One line open for you at 800-642-1234, and you can always email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question. Let's go to Kyle in Wisconsin Rapids. Kyle, thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me on. I had to renovate my basement when I purchased the house. I'm in the central sands here, a lot of sand soils, Plainfield sands, and gutters aren't required up here on old zoning. House was 1950s. The walls were caving in at the frost line 3.5 inches. So they dug everything back about 8 feet, and they put in a new drain, rock screening, waterproofing, dimple board, and they connected, and I had them put in a new sump pump. Now, a lot of houses around here don't have sump pumps, but this old one from the 50s had a concrete drain trench underneath the floor, and the whole floor is graded to go towards the middle of the basement where those drains were. When they did these renovations, these repairs, they disconnected the internal drain, which, again, was just an open trench underneath the concrete slab, and connected that sump pump to the exterior French drain around the house. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether it would be worth opening that back up on the interior and connecting those drains in the floor back to the sump pump, or if I should put, like, a box with a well I can throw in there if there's ever flooding, because right now all the water goes to the center and there's no way to get it out if something were to happen, like a water were to bust or something.
Okay. Yeah.
And the center is a trench, so if you have one or two access points with a 3 or 4 inch drain pipe, that would take care of it in emergency. Is that correct then, Kyle?
Yeah. And I've got a 2 inch slab gravel screen underneath. Right now, those drains just go straight to the gravel underneath the basement slab.
Right.
And it was just an open trench before. So.
Yeah. And there are some things that we just can't know by looking at a house or looking at a basement. And that is, what's the water level underneath it? You know, if it's a house up on a hill, it may work just fine. If it's in the sands and it's somewhat low and we get, you know, the 16 inches of rain in 3 weeks, that water table may come up, so it's not going to work. So I don't know what that situation is, and you probably don't either, unless you got a hydrological report from the area. So it sounds like your idea is probably, it's not terribly expensive. It's buying a little insurance and probably some peace of mind. So I think it's probably a good investment one way or the other.
Yeah. There you go, Kyle. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck with that. Appreciate it. Jim and Webster, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned radon in another caller's situation.
Yeah.
That we all need to be concerned about it. I don't recall hearing about radon until about, I don't know, it seems like 30 or 35 years ago. What did people do with radon before? Was it identified? When was radon problem identified?
We had a lot of leaky houses way back.
come to my 1851 house, Jim. No radon problem whatsoever, and I could have a box of uranium in the basement. The air changes were very, very frequent. But what we started doing in the 50s, the 60s, and especially the 70s with the oil crisis is we started tightening up our houses. In the old days, you had an old-fashioned furnace that was almost an open combustion fastened to a chimney. And then your water heater was the same thing. So every time the water heater came on, the furnace came on, you were sucking air out of the basement and sending it up the chimney. So you had a radon control pump, except it was called a furnace and a water heater. But once we go to side-vented closed-loop systems, we end up with fewer air changes. And we know that air buoyancy exists because we've seen hot air balloons. And so the warm air in your house in the summer and winter is always rising, which is depressurizing the basement. So now we're no longer really bringing air into the basement or removing air from the basement. That basement can get pretty heavily radon laden and then start working its way up. But when we do radon measurements in-house, now I shouldn't use the imperial we there because I don't do it, but when the experts do it, what you find on the second floor, the first floor, and the basement are vastly different readings. So basically, Jim, we've reduced airflow, and because we've reduced airflow, when the radon does come in, it's not being removed the way it used to.
There you go. That's exactly right. Jim, thank you very much for calling. David in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, David.
Well, my question might have something to do with the radon and also the caller who about the condensation on his windows.
Yeah.
My friend had the same problem, condensation on his windows, and he had an air exchanger put in, and he said it went away completely.
Right.
What can you tell me about air exchangers?
Well, we're just talking with Jim how we've tightened up our houses, and we've tightened up our houses to the extent that the air inside may not be of terribly good quality. So the heat recovery vent system, used to be called heat exchangers, now heat recovery vent systems. If I were building a new house, I would never build a new house without an HRV in it. They simply, I think, are becoming essential. So I think that if you have a newer house or an older house that you've tightened up, if you have condensation issues, you do want to look, you want to look for the source of the moisture. But the HRV is going to help both with condensation and with your indoor air quality. So I think a good investment.
So how do we put those, how do we, after the fact, we've got an existing house, David's got.
Mm-hmm. Fairly simple. Think of the old water heaters, Larry. The old water heaters have this hood on the top and a 3-inch pipe that went to your chimney. And now we're putting in side-vented water heaters. With the HRV, we need an intake and an outtake, just like we have in most of our modern furnaces, but it's no more complicated than that. It has to be integrated into the duct system, the fan system, and so that maybe the furnace isn't calling for heat or air conditioning, but we need to circulate air. But most decent heating contractors know exactly how to do this.
Yeah, yeah. David, good luck with that. Appreciate the call. Dawn in Wausau, we go to you now. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. So my issue is that I noticed peeling paint under a window, and I confirmed it was caused by moisture using a moisture sensor. Mm-hmm. I had the folks that installed the window, you know, years back, check it out, and they said actually it's not the window. So I'm wondering what's the differential? I mean, could it even be like from the roof and it's leaking down the stud? Like, what are the other possibilities?
Well, unfortunately, you can't show me a picture. Is this peeling paint you said is under the window?
Yes.
Okay. If it's under the window, 9 times out of 10, it's the window. And it may not be the window itself, but it may be where the weather-resistant barrier on your house is secured or not secured to the window. Now, Dawn, how old is your house?
It is from the 50s, but it was renovated in 2007, which is when everything was done, and it was actually done very well. The person was a contractor and was going to live in the home himself.
Now, when you say it was renovated, do you mean all the siding was taken off the exterior and new siding was put on?
Correct.
Okay. And so done in the 70s, that may have been with Tyvek, Typar, Bloxit, or one of the large dimension sheets, you know, the 8-foot, 10-foot rolls. What we may have is simply a tape failure at the window.
Oh.
So if there's casing on the exterior, it's fairly easy to take the casing off and see if the tape has failed. If the tape has failed, we have to identify who manufactured the WRB. I mean, if it's Tyvek, we've got to use Tyvek tape. If it's Blockit, we have to use the Kimberly-Clark tape, even though they say you don't. But believe me, you have to. So it's probably something as simple as that. And then they can check the flashing above the window at the same time. So this is something that any competent carpenter or handyman should be able to do from you, for you. But if it's underneath the window, it's not coming down a stud. If it was above the window, then there's limitless possibilities. But under the window, it is probably the head connection or the side connection between the window and the weather-resistant barrier, and that fortunately is something easy to check.
Yeah, fortunately. Dawn, good luck with it. Thank you for calling. Shelley in Madison, your turn. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, thank you. First of all, I live in an old 1800 farmhouse that's built on a hill, so no waters, no radon. But what I was calling about is I wondered about the egress window discussion and why people don't use, I don't know the right term, but I call them the witch's doors, those old doors like in The Wizard of Oz where you could go down your basement and it really sealed off everything. Could you talk about those and people using them?
Yeah, those old doors are sort of nice because some houses did not have a stairway in the house to get down to the basement. There wasn't a lot of reason to go in the basement because in my house, the wood stoves are all upstairs. There was no furnace in the basement. Well, actually, my house had a kitchen in the basement, though, because it was so small when it was originally built. So they had a stairway for that. But a lot of old houses, they had an exterior stairway because they hauled canned goods down and stored some things in the basement, and that's it. So the old, yeah, the Wicked Witch of the West or whatever it was in Wizard of Oz, so you have those old doors, and of course, they're still made. Bilco and other companies make nice new modern sealed ones out of steel that you can lock, and they are indeed perfectly useful. We have to remember what an egress window is, Shelley, is it helps meet the Uniform Dwelling Code if we want to use that basement for something that requires egress and light.
Light is
so
the biggie.
Light is the biggie. So if you want a bedroom, your windows have to equal 8% of the floor space. So if you got a 10 by 10 bedroom, you've got to have a 2 foot by 4 foot window or a 3 by 3 window or whatever. So it's really a different thing. Your witch's door, as you call it, or your Bilco door, as we usually call it, gives access to doing this or that in the basement, but does not allow you to finish a room down there.
And that's why late, I remember having to... Well, wait a minute. Shelley, did you have follow-up to that? You good?
No, I thought that the egress doors, I appreciate that explanation, but I thought the main purpose was so an individual who may be sleeping or living in the basement could quickly get out of the basement. And I thought that there's a solution that I don't think those, especially the new ones, don't leak water like some of the egress windows. So I didn't know all that light stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm
certainly.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. John Freiberger, our guest today. Questions for John. We're talking home renovation and repair. If you got an issue you want to talk about, or maybe just a question, I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. John wants to know, what's the best way to remove the musty smell?
Oh, dear. Well, what's making the musty smell? If we've got mold in the basement, we need to find that. So I'm not sure what exactly John is smelling. Is this an older wood house where we've got some condensation on wood and we've got a little bit of mold and we have drywall in the basement that if we take it off the wall, it's going to look scary? I think we need to do a little bit of investigation, because if it smells musty, that usually means that we've got mold. If we have mold, that means we have water, and we need to discover the source of the water, the source of the mold, which is going to be on something, you know, organic. Yeah. And we need to get rid of it to make the house healthy.
Christy emailed to say she would like to install a doorway where an existing window is located. Is it okay to take the window out, cut the framework for a new door? Obviously, framing out for whatever size door they choose.
You do need to meet code, because you may be changing the, well, when your house was built, the code probably didn't exist. So if we're going to make a modification, we have to make sure that anything that we're doing is not going to cause the house to start moving or settling. So if you talk to a competent contractor, they may say, Christy, yes, I can do that, but I have to have 2 2x4s on the side. I need a 2x6 or a 2x8 header over the top of it. It's not much more complicated to do it right. In fact, long term, it's less complicated to do it right. So talk to a knowledgeable contractor. Make sure you get a permit, because if you get a permit, then hopefully you've got an inspector from the city, the town, or the county stopping by to look at it and say, yep, that's okay. The last thing you want to do is put in a door, not get a permit, sell the house, and 2 years later you get sued because the bedroom above it is moving.
Those permits, they're not that expensive, really.
Worst case, you're maybe looking at $150. And we have to remember that somebody's got to come over and look at this. And technically, they should be looking at it twice. That rarely happens.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, there we go. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yes, several years ago, I had gutter helmet put installed over my rain gutters.
Okay.
And unlike leaf filter, it doesn't, you know, it's not a mesh that goes right over the gutter and let rain in. It's sort of like sheet metal that overlaps the gutter.
Right.
But
relies upon surface tension to get the water around that curved edge and then to fall into the gutter. And what happens if we've got a lot of velocity? And the velocity is higher than the surface tension.
Yeah.
Then it sheets right off the roof without going into the gutter.
The birds birds built nests, and it blocked the flow of water in the rain gutter to the downspout. And I was looking out one window one day when we had a heavy rain. The rain was pouring out of the gutter, but it wasn't coming out of the downspout.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go up there with a ladder and clean out a big mess of mud and grass and God knows what else in two spots on a rain gutter along my house and a couple of spots on a rain gutter along my garage.
Mm-hmm. This does not sound like an advertisement for gutter helmets. Am I right on that?
Stuff it in there so the birds can't get in there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, we have these things that work under what used to be normal circumstances. But as we said earlier in the program, now when we're getting 5 2-inch plus rains, I mean, look at Florida the last couple of weeks. We're getting 6 inches an hour. Gutter helmets cannot manage that. So we have to, it is a real problem, especially for older people. They've got a tall two-story house. They've got to have something on those gutters. And I do like the open mesh that just allow gravity to come in. The other thing, Larry, that Ron causes me to make this point, but I have a lot of people calling me about their gutter problems, and their gutters are just fine. They just can't manage the water.
Yeah.
And a 5-inch gutter often doesn't do it anymore. And so we've got to go to a 6-inch gutter. I had a rain at the farm, and my brand-new giant 6-inch U-gutter was overflowing. Well, we were just getting that much rain off of the roof. So if you're replacing the gutters on your house and you've had any kind of problems in the past, upsize those gutters by at least an inch. Yeah. And make sure your downspouts are big enough. Because if you've got a 6-inch gutter and a 3-inch downspout, believe me, that doesn't work.
Ron, thank you very much for calling. Glenn in Fond du Lac, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a house that was built in 98. The fella put 2 bedrooms in the basement on his own, and there's no egress. I may sell it soon. Do I just list that as a 2-bedroom rather as a 4, or do I have to eliminate those 2 bedrooms downstairs?
No, you do not have to eliminate them, but what you need to do is call around and find an intelligent real estate broker to work with you, and you are going to have to fill in a real estate condition report and disclosure. And you want to make very sure to say that there are 2 rooms in the basement that in the past have been used as bedrooms but are not legal to use as bedrooms because the windows are not adequate. That way, whoever buys the house knows that. And they may buy the house, Glenn, saying, you know, we're going to put in a couple of egress windows and we can buy Glenn's house then because we want basement bedrooms. But this can be taken care of very easily by filling in the correct paperwork so that the buyer does not come back to you after a year and sue you saying, I thought it was a 4-bedroom, but this is something that your professional listing broker is going to take care of for you.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Glenn, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. John Freiberger, registered home inspector, his company, Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Talking home renovation and repair today on the show, Larry Mailer here with John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Bill in Red Granite, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm interested in learning the proper procedure to put a metal roof over a garage with existing 3-tab shingles. I've gone online and looked, and some places say you fur the roof out with 1x4s and put your metal roof right over everything. Now, what is the proper procedure?
Well, the first thing I would do, how old is this garage, Bill?
20 years.
20 years, okay. And you really want to check to make sure we've got no deflection in that roof whatsoever. And basically, that's you can run a string from one end of the peak to the other, yeah, assuming it's a single, you know, single ridge roof, and make sure we have no deflection because we start putting metal roofs on roofs that have any deflection, we end up with all kinds of issues. So a metal roof is something that's going to last you 45 years, if it's a good metal roof. You know, it's a standing seam, not the type, you know, like barn roof that you're just basically putting on with screws with little gussets around, waterproof gussets. So if you're doing a really good roof that's going to last a long time, check it out structurally first. I would definitely take everything off. It probably, if it's 20 years old, it probably has plywood or OSB. Take a look at the sheathing, make sure it's put on right. Is there a 16th inch gap between the sheathing? Because if the sheathing swells up under that metal roof, it can distort the metal roof. So you're making a big investment in the metal. So I would strip everything off, check it out structurally, check out the sheathing, and I don't know if you're going to do this yourself, probably not, but talk to your Red Granite roofer and tell them you want everything done right.
Bill, thanks again for calling. Ed in Plainville, Minnesota. Hi, Ed.
I got a question. I got a house that's built 1956. I have redwood siding, the original. I don't like
vinyl, and I do not like steel. What are my options for a house that old?
Oh, is the redwood not salvageable?
No, it's old. It's been hailed on, beat up, and everything else.
Too bad. Too bad. Wood siding, of course, as you know, Ed, I mean, you've got siding that has been on there for almost 70 years, and, yeah, it's gotten beat up. The wood siding in my house, some of it's 173 years old, and it's still good. I am replacing it now, but it's been 173 years.
Yeah.
Depending on how big your house is, Ed, the problem with wood is it's very, very expensive. You know, I like Western Red Cedar. I'm putting it on my house, but when I put it on my house, it's going to last another 173 years. So the next best thing is probably one of the composites. And I don't think there's a lot of difference in longevity between the cementous siding that you can get from the James Hardie Company, and you can look it up online, and a siding like the LP. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're going to use a Miratec trim or an LP trim with a, you know, you can mix and match with the Hardie. So do a little bit of investigating. What you will find is the LP warranty is lousy. If you do have a finish failure, it's very, very limited. So when you invest in anything, read the warranty very, very carefully. Are you thinking of doing some of this work yourself, or are you going to hire a contractor?
I'll tear all the redwood off. It's a Rambler. It's a 40-foot Rambler, walkout basement.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to do the cedar, but I can't find anything around this part of Minnesota where I could get it. You know, I'd like to do the front and the one side of the house cedar, and then the back side something else.
Okay. The cedar is available. If you will email me at frei@chorus.net, and chorus is spelled like a group of singers, C-H-O-R-U-S, I will provide you with my contact for cedar. I've been getting it here near Platteville, Wisconsin, and my guess is the truck probably drives right past Plainville. So email me if you like. Certainly, the nice thing about replacing redwood with cedar is you do one side of the house 1 year and do the other side, you know, 2 years later. It's not going to really look funny or anything else. The other thing I would suggest you do, Ed, is read a little bit about rain screen systems. What I'm doing on my house, which had the original cedar put right against the tar paper, nailed the sheathing, is I'm putting 3/8-inch strips behind the cedar. That allows the humidity to level out. It allows the cedar to back drain. And, of course, if you invest in cedar, you want to prime all sides of it. Because, again, if you do this right, that cedar siding is going to be good 150 years from now. And you have made a very good investment. So feel free to email me, ask me questions. I can send you any number of things on the proper ways of installing cedar. And I think I can maybe set you up with a dealer who could supply it to you.
Ed, does that help out?
Yeah. Can you run that email by me again?
Sure. frei@chorus.net.
C-H-O-U-R-E-S?
C-H-O-R-U-S. Just like a group of singers.
.net.
.com.
Not .net. .net.
Okay. Thank you. .net.
All right. There we go. I'm sure you're going to be hearing from Ed.
That's my pleasure. I hear from lots of listeners.
Let's see. Mike in Black River Falls, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
So I have we bought a cabin in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. The original cabin was built in the 40s. They then extended it and remodeled most of it in the early 2000s. I want to say it was like 2008. So most of the cabin now is on a cement slab about knee high.
Mm-hmm.
They put in central ducting for heat and AC, but in the new section, it's underneath the slab.
Mm-hmm.
Is what we're starting to notice now is that sometimes there'll be, after a lot of rain, obviously there'll be a moldy smell. And even one time there was standing water in one of the tubes.
Right.
And I guess I'm just not sure, you know, what to do.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Mike. when you look into the underfloor heat ducts, are they PVC, the white plastic, or are they metal?
Yes. They're PVC metal shims that come up to the vent.
Okay. Well, yeah, we use PVC for our plumbing supply and waste pipes in our house, so water's not going to hurt the PVC. So we do have some leaks. It isn't real tight, so it's coming into the joint. PVC does not turn moldy. The dirt in the PVC turns moldy. So I think what we need to do is just try to get those ducts cleaned. You're going to get some water from time to time, but so what? You may have to simply have the ducts cleaned every few years. Does that help, Mike?
It does. That makes a lot of sense. I assumed it was going to be something like that. I was hoping it wasn't like a catastrophic problem where you have to try to redo all that stuff.
No, I don't think that it is. Talking about catastrophic HVAC systems, because we do have some slab houses that have metal underneath them. And a lot of them were built in the 40s right after the war because we just didn't have the material to do full basements. And a lot of those houses now, we have the metal simply rusting through. So we have continuous problems with radon and moisture. And in those houses, what we're doing is we are redesigning and putting the HVAC system in the attic, and then we are insulating the attic under the roof so the attic is part of the heated space. But it doesn't sound like you have to do anything like that, but that may be in your far future.
All right. Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We got somebody with a leaking upstairs, wondering about a leaky upstairs toilet or shower or bathtub. Maybe it's wondering if that's the bulge in their ceiling, if that's the blame is coming from there.
That probably sounds like it. It sounds like it's time to open the ceiling and see what we have up there. And that's about all one can do. Have a carpenter or do it yourself or handyman take the ceiling down. Remember to wear dust masks and things. There could be some lead paint, and we don't want to be breathing in the dust either. Have it investigated by the plumber. If it's sort of old, the plumber may say, you know, while this is open, let's just replace all this. And yeah, then you're probably good for another 50 years.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe you could comment a bit on the news that's been coming out a lot about electricity and new ways or different ways of heating homes and air conditioning homes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's actually getting to be one of my favorite subjects, which is probably why you asked. The day of the gas furnace and gas water heater, I think, if things go well, it's something we're simply not going to have in 20 years. We're finding that in some cities now, as the cities expand to the suburbs are putting in, they're not putting in gas pipe. They're only putting electrical. So I think that we have to take a look at heat pumps for heating our houses and heat transfer units for heating hot water and HRV systems, everything run by electricity, as being the wave of the future. There are places like in Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, where most of the gas pipe is 100 to 110 years old in the older part of the city. Now, they can spend billions tearing up the streets, trying to replace this old cast iron pipe. In Boston, there's a major leak. There are three major leaks in every mile of pipe. I mean, the loss and the methane coming out of those pipes is just terrible. Now, do we really want to spend billions to dig up all that gas pipe, or do we just provide the electricity so that everything can be switched over to electrical HVAC appliances? And certainly that is the way that I see, that's what I see in the future.
What about the cost on something like heat pumps for an individual homeowner?
I have not priced one recently. They are going to be more expensive than, well, there's furnaces and there's furnaces, isn't there? I mean, you can still buy an 80% efficient furnace. It's going to cost you a fortune to run it. And obviously that's going to be cheaper. You know, the big box special for $1,555, you get a 80,000 BTU furnace. Well, it's junk. So I think when we take a look at things, we've got to take a look at what our costs are over 20 years. And when we get to that, I think we're looking at heat pumps are going to be very cost efficient.
John Freiberger, our guest, he'll be with us right up till 12:30, and looking forward to talking with him some more and getting your calls. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Taking a look at home remodeling and repair with our guest today, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Great to have you listening in, and lots of callers online and an email. So let's go to the phones first with Pete in Madison. Pete, what's on your mind?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Freiberger. I appreciate your ears. So two weeks ago, we lost power in Madison, and the only reason I survived, or we in our block, was that we had gas. So what's the consumer, what's the homeowner to do when the local utility doesn't feel like fixing it? It was a small problem. There was other more pressing issues. Mm-hmm. So you either bury the power lines, which are hanging on these trees all over the place, and
right.
Our trees just take it out. What are we to do? As you know, the only reason we survive is because we had gas for 3 days.
Well, we will see all power lines buried at some point, except some of the big cross-country high-tension lines, and even the big lines along the Madison Beltline. Those could have actually been buried. It just would have cost more. But the inefficiency of the old wire, which has higher resistance, and so we have more loss, plus the incredible problems that we have with trees, because trees grow forever and they're always getting into power lines, and MG&E can't come and just cut them off and leave stumps behind. So we are going to see lines buried. I don't know how long it's going to be in each neighborhood, but eventually we are not going to see all of these telephone, cable, and electrical lines going up and down our streets. And certainly when you go out into, the newer parts of Fitchburg and things, you don't see any above-ground wires, except maybe the high-tension lines. So this is simply the wave of the future. Yeah, it is unfortunate that, we end up occasionally when things don't get repaired as quickly as we like. But the wave of the future is buried lines, better efficiency, and going to all electric-based appliances.
Yeah. There you go, Pete. Thank you for calling. Hedda in Sister Bay, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I own a Wausau-built home. It was built in 1971. I have a basement, so I was told they blasted in order to provide me with a basement here. Mm-hmm. The walls are lined with styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a 1-inch styrofoam. I know there was water infiltration before I bought the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I continue to get some water issues down there. My question is, should I remove that styrofoam? I see there's a small crack on the outside of the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
I have remediated a lot of the water issues by, like you mentioned earlier in the program, I insisted upon a 6-inch gutter mm-hmm. the way around. So, but it's still the moisture down in that basement.
Right.
You know, if I don't have a humidifier running down there all the time, unfortunately, I go to Illinois for, like a month at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So, should I leave that? Does that styrofoam on the walls do anything for insulation or?
Yes, it does help with the insulation. The problem is it's illegal. if you get a fire in the basement, it is going to be extremely toxic. So if we use lots of styrofoam on houses, mostly on the exterior, but when we use it on the interior, we have to have a fire barrier over the top of it. So usually when we find it in basements, there's then a stud wall and drywall in front of it, which the theory is the smoke alarm goes off when we get out of the house. So what you have in that basement right now is a fire hazard, and it does not meet the uniform dwelling code. So I would remove it so you can see the walls. In 71, I don't think that Wausau Homes would have put that on the interior. I'm trying to remember. It was built in 71, but which code was it? Was it constructed under? Yeah. It may have been constructed under like the 68 or 69 code. Mm-hmm. So they may have put it in, a previous owner may have put it in, but I think you should get rid of it.
Yeah. There you go, Hedda. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Helen in Appleton. Helen, hi.
Hello. Thank you for your program. Enjoying it. I have no rain or water problems, thank goodness, but I do have a question about a gas fireplace. Saved my marriage. My husband and I are disagreeing about leaving the pilot light on during the summer. It throws off a fair amount of heat, mm-hmm. and the paint, the black paint, is chipping around that black metal frame that holds the glass window.
Yes.
On it. Yeah. And I've heard lots of people say, oh, I just leave that pilot light on year-round. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, is that safe to do?
Maybe. But you are burning gas. You're not helping climate change. You're getting some condensation off the gas in the fireplace, which can cause long-term corrosion. And by code, that fireplace has to have an easily accessible shutoff valve. So you simply find that shutoff valve. If one doesn't exist, you get one installed. You shut it off in the summer, and you can relight it in October. You'll save money, help the environment, and preserve the fireplace from condensation.
Yeah, I have a gas fireplace, and in mine, when you turn it off, there's a shutoff for the that mm-hmm. automatically shuts off the gas, and there's no pilot light.
Right. The newer ones are all electronic ignition, as we were saying. Everything is switching to electricity, but I suppose at some point we're going to have electric fireplaces as well.
Yeah. Well, they're out there.
They certainly are.
Christy and Dane County, we're on to you now. Hi, Christy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We have a 52-year-old raised ranch home. We have a toilet in our downstairs laundry room. And when I'm down there, I hear what I think is trickling of water from the toilet tank into the bowl.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do about it?
Call your plumber. Most likely we have a worn gasket or we have some calcium. Because your toilet's probably on cold water, you probably do not have water softener for your cold water. So you get some calcium buildup, and then the toilet simply leaks. So we're running water that you're paying for, most likely. Well, one way or the other, you're paying for it. Either the electricity to your well, or it's on your water bill. So have your plumber come in and replace the fill valve, flush valve inside the stool. It's relatively inexpensive. And things could get worse.
Yeah, so. There you go, Christy. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Richard in Crystal Lake, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yes, so I work for a builder, and in certain situations, we're using closed cell foam in our attic assembly, creating a unvented attic assembly, okay?
Right.
And recently, within the past couple of years, we've had a few problems, and on the outside, it appears that the shingles are humping up, are buckling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've done a lot of research and stuff, and we haven't really gotten anywhere that far, but basically, we've been told there's moisture getting into the plywood, and that's moving the plywood or OSB decking, whatever we're using.
Yeah.
And that's creating the problem. Have you heard anything like this? Is there something we're doing improperly, potentially?
Potentially. I see this problem a lot. In fact, I have it on my very large barn at home. And what happened is, they put on OSB sheathing, and they did not gap it a 16th of an inch. So any kind of moisture, no matter where it's from, or just, you know, air humidity, and the OSB swells, and if there's no gap, you're going to get ridges on it. So the first thing to check is to see whether your crew that is putting on the roof sheathing is doing it correctly, and maybe go to 3/16 of an inch or an eighth or something to give yourself just a little bit more room. The closed cell foam is going to stop all humidity from going through the foam. Depending on how deep you're spraying it, I like to spray it over the top cord of the trusses or the rafters so that I do not get moisture transfer through the wood. So I like to seal the whole thing. But between those two things, you really should not have a problem. And whether this is actually due to the closed cell foam in the unventilated attic or due to atmospheric humidity, I think at this point is a toss-up.
Oh, all right. Does that help, Richard?
Well, so we've opened it up, and, I mean, we have the gapping right. I mm-hmm. mean, we've had scenarios where we're using 5/8 plywood.
Uh-huh.
And kind of what, you know, and we're talking to some guys who are high up there, and they're saying that even 6 inches, a little bit of moisture is getting through there. And kind of what I'm wondering is, you know, we're not using HRVs in our home, and I'm
right.
wondering if that's part of the problem. And I have other people in the company who do not agree, but I kind of believe that's our problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another consideration. I think you're making a good point, Richard, and I think HRVs and having a, you know, you can walk around that house and read the humidity in it, read the humidity in the attic, and see what we've got. And the attic is going to be warmer than the rest of the house because it's warmer. It's going to have more moisture load because we're getting moisture pushed into that attic. The other thing to take a look at is your shingles. I know that GAF is fine and will warranty shingles over a hot roof. Some other firms won't. It's possible that you're using a shingle that is not approved for that application. So go online and check the literature for the manufacturer you're using, whether it's GAF, CertainTeed, or whoever, and make sure that that shingle does have a warranty, because you certainly don't want to have an unwarranted shingle on a house. And the other thing to do, I think, is call GAF. Talk to one of their science guys. Say, do we have a problem? And he may say, well, you've got to use the Timberline Ultra. You can't just use the Timberline. So there's a lot of little things there. We're playing with little tiny incremental inputs here and trying to parse from what the outputs exactly what the inputs were. And that's sort of difficult. So I think, you know, do a little more research as you are doing. Check humidity, talk to GAF, CertainTeed, whoever you are using. And I think the other thing to do is to ask them, and this is something I have not looked into, so I do not know the answer, Richard, is when we take a look at underlayments over hot roofs, is there something that's better than others?
All right. There you go, Richard. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Jim in Kenosha. Jim, hello. Thank you for calling.
You're very welcome. I have a 1923 duplex that has the old-fashioned plaster, and mm-hmm. there was this comparison that talked about how many hundreds of gallons of water that the plaster can safely hold versus the modern drywall,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of shocking. I have a problem with my wall insulation. This is point two. I had those holes drilled, and it was just 4 inches of airspace, and I had it stuffed with the modern cellulose.
Yeah.
And I'm having a problem now where I smell mold
yep.
in just one little spot of the house, and I cannot troubleshoot it anywhere. And is it possible for that insulation to get wet? Because it's not
yep.
anything like closed cell. It's just the cellulose.
Right. It can indeed get wet. The other problem that we're having, Jim, when we're infilling those interstitial voids is that we are now lowering the temperature in that wall cavity. So before, in the winter, you know, it was 72 degrees in the apartment, and the inside of the wall was, you know, 55 degrees. Now we've got that cellulose in. It's the inside of the wall is warm on the inside, but when we get to the outside, we are at the point where we're condensing. So what we're finding is we're finding moisture condensing on the backside of the sheathing, you know, the side of the sheathing inside the wall, and growing mold. So this is pretty problematical, and I'm personally of the belief, I'm not sure all the science backs me up, is that we need to be foaming our walls and not putting in cellulose, and the foam that we use needs to be a closed cell foam, and that's much, much, much more expensive. But we need to reduce the humidity that's going into the walls.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I just spent a lot of money doing that. And is that like a given that it's doing that, that every time you have this system? In other words, it's a defective system that home insulators are performing now in the 21st century?
I'm not going to insult all the insulators in Wisconsin by saying yes, but I'll say, Jim, that I'm very concerned about it. Now, if you have a house that's got a really good interior vapor barrier, which is basically no house, or if you retrofit, so you use a vapor barrier type paint on the inside of your plaster and you seal everything you possibly can, you know, like all of the openings for the outlets and the switches, you've got foam pads, etc., you can certainly reduce it. Plus, the lower you keep the humidity in the apartments in this duplex, certainly the better. But if you've got a duplex at 55% in the middle of winter with leaky walls, I think I can pretty much guarantee you that you're going to have mold issues. And long term, this is more scary, Jim, is we're going to rust off the nails that are holding the sheathing to the 2x4 studs. And at that point, we're going to end up with structural problems.
That does not sound good.
Yeah. So this is, you know, it's an area where there's a lot of different factors, but certainly keeping the humidity low, trying to reduce the air loss into the house, but we're going to have humidity even driven through the plaster unless we cover the interior with a moisture-resistant paint.
What should the humidity, I mean, what's the best humidity level to maintain in a house winter or summer?
If we have a house that has issues, which is most houses, then I really think we, between 40, 42, 43, up to 45% is where I feel comfortable. Now, I've got a very old house. It's somewhat leaky. I've done a lot of things like holding the siding off the wall by 3/8 of an inch, so I've got more breathability. I've got old-fashioned tar paper, which I still think is the best weather-resistant barrier out there because it changes its vapor permeability based upon vapor pressure. I mean, we've been trying for years to invent that, to reinvent that, and we're beginning to reinvent it. But even in my house, I really try to keep the humidity relatively low. Mold is such a big issue. Some people aren't bothered by it, but so many other people are bothered by it. And I'm very worried about kids that are growing up in houses where we have mold growth on the interior and long-term exposure.
Jim, thank you again for calling. Kim emailed to say they have a steel tub with 2-inch steel lip. Is it necessary to caulk? They left the mildew-resistant grout uncaulked, and it looks great. No mold forming at all. It's been several weeks. Do they need to caulk around the tub knowing that there is a steel lip underneath the tile and grout?
Yeah, there's a steel lip that comes up, and it's got you have the tile or the tile backer attached very tightly to it, which means you have capillary action. So the water that gets into that groove can actually move upward capillary action, and you could end up with some problems there. So I would go out and find a very high-quality 20-year warranted mildew-resistant caulk. I would go ahead and caulk that because you have a water issue, and the water is going uphill due to capillary action, due to the tight fit between the lip of the tub and the tile and its backing.
And there's a relationship between price on caulk and value on caulk. And
there's a reason why Mercedes and Yugos have different price points, Larry. It's all about quality.
All right. Aaron in Madison, thank you for calling.
Question about mold detection. I rent a house, and I'm just kind of curious if there's any sort of products I can get at, like Menards or something, to help me to detect if there could be mold in certain areas without, you know, spending a bunch of money to have people come in and look at it.
Now, the answer, Eric, is no. It's we need a bunch of money. Now, you can get cheap, like their mold wipe strips. So, you wipe the top of the refrigerator or something, you send it into the lab, and they go, yeah, it's moldy. Well, it doesn't really help you. It doesn't quantify anything. The problem with mold is we need to know how much there is per cubic meter of air. And that requires hiring somebody to come in with test equipment to do air sampling and then the filters that they use with the air sample have to go out to a lab, and you are talking hundreds of dollars. If you have a health concern, I would go ahead and do it, because you have a right to live in a healthy environment. And if you need, you're in the Madison area, there's a very good firm here in Madison. And if you email me at frei@chorus.net, if you're interested in that, I can give you a contact at that firm and they could do some testing for you.
And again, that's frei@chorus.net.
Right. And chorus spelled like a group of singers.
All right. There we go. Thank you very much, Sharon. Barbara in Montello, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, you're talking about mold in houses, and they've got a lot of products that they're making out of hemp now that doesn't mold. Hemp is a great product.
Mm-hmm. The dirt on the hemp molds, though.
Yeah.
What?
The dirt hemp on the hemp molds. I mean, we have a lot of things that don't mold, like PVC, steel, enamel, yeah. But everything gets dirty.
Yeah.
And you add dirt, which is usually organic, and you add moisture, and you get mold. So you have these nice hemp drapes, but your house humidity goes up a little bit, and you've got dust, and all of a sudden you've got mold on your hemp drapes. Well, it's not on the hemp. It's on the dirt on the hemp. And so this is the confounder.
Yeah.
Is we can use all these really safe things, and yet all we need is organic dirt of some sort, organic dust, and humidity beyond 65%, and we end up with mold.
Yeah, there you go. Barbara, thank you for calling. Laura in Madison, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have an old four-square Craftsman in Madison, and I'm wondering the best way to insulate the basement rim joist. There was some old insulation that was put up there that was mildewed, and I've taken it down, and I'm wondering what to replace it with.
Is it mildew, or is it simply gray because of air leaks?
I think it's degraded because of air leaks.
Right. So you're very wise then to go ahead and get it insulated. Now, this is a four square, so you have a concrete foundation, and the ring joist and the joist are sitting on top of that foundation?
That's right.
And you're a foot or so out of grade?
Yes.
I'm betting.
And the back of it, it's well above a foot. I'd say it's more like 3 feet.
Go to Closed Cell Insulation. There are several good companies in Madison that can spray that out for you. That's going to stop the air leaks and give you a vapor barrier. And we're not endangering your wood because we're far enough out of the soil that we don't have to worry about what's coming through the concrete.
Laura, there you go. Thank you so much. And John, we're out of time. Thank you so much. It's great to have you with us, and you'll be back in a couple of months, and we'll do it all over again.
I will. Been a pleasure to spend this time with you, Larry.
John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates of Fitchburg. By way of full disclosure, Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So great to have him with us today. And coming up, we're going to take a look at an International Wood Sculpture Festival that's taking place in Monona, Wisconsin. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. If you're looking for something amazing to do this weekend or perhaps next week, you might think about going to the Harry Whitehorse International Wood Sculpture Festival. It's being held in Monona, Wisconsin, right next to Madison. And we're talking about it today on the show. Larry Mueller here, by the way, with a couple of guests. One of them, Gene Delcord. He is the founder of the festival, a Madison-based wood sculptor. He was mentored by Harry himself. Gene, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming to be with us.
Thank you, sir.
Also with us today, Deb Whitehorse. Deb is vice president of the festival's steering committee, and Harry is her late husband. Deb, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us. Great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So as we talk to our two guests today, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got questions about the festival. What do you want to know about wood sculpture carving? Have you seen a sculpture by Harry Whitehorse? I have one. I'm lucky one to have one in my own home. It's one of my prized possessions, as a matter of fact. It's a muskie that Harry carved for me quite a long time ago. I think it was 1988 or thereabout. So it's one of my prized possessions. Maybe you have one. Maybe you have other questions about sculptures. I hope you'll join in with a question or a comment or an experience to share. Number's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You know, the festival is coming up this weekend to begin with. Gene, maybe give us an overview of what you can expect to see if you go.
Well, tomorrow at 5 o'clock, there's going to be an opening ceremony where some representatives from the Ho-Chunk Nation will be there to speak. Their tribal president will speak to greet people to San Damiano, which is ancestral Ho-Chunk land. The mayor of Monona, Mary O'Connor, will be also speaking to greet everybody to Monona. And I'll introduce the artists. A person from the Friends of San Damiano will also talk about welcoming everyone to San Damiano as well. And then there'll be a little powwow demonstration so that the artists who are coming from all over the world will get to see Native American dance and hear some songs. And from there, we go to a meal, and that will be it for the night. But Saturday morning, we start working at 9 o'clock.
And sculpting.
Sculpting, yes, sir.
and we can observe that happening. And there's, as I imagine and know, there's food, there's some entertainment. Describe what that might be.
There'll be food vendors every day at lunch and in the evening. On Tuesday night, there will be actually San Damiano holds a beer garden four times a summer, and this will be their first one of the year. And the Cashbox Kings, a Chicago-based blues band, will be performing. And should be great fun, wonderful music. There'll be some wonderful food. There'll be more music on Friday as Monona will hold its first Make Music Monona ever. And San Damiano will also be one of the venues. So we'll have musicians playing here all day.
You know, this event, it's the first invitational international festival that's dedicated to a Native American person. As a lot, you know, that's a significant event, Gene.
Right, I agree. And you know, Harry was a mentor to me when I was just starting out in the art world. He was a very good friend, and his art is so, as you know, his art is wonderful. And I really want him to never be forgotten. You know, hopefully this will draw attention and people will be interested in finding his sculptures around Dane County and checking them out.
Oh, there's just some beautiful stuff. Deb, I want to get you involved here. Tell us a little more about Harry's story. I kind of know it, but share it. How did he find his passion for sculpting?
He was born with it. There's no doubt. And he was surrounded by people who created art. In particular, his uncle, George Seymour, mentored him even as a small child. He taught him how to create jewelry and things made out of wood, everything, you know, the traditional things that Ho-Chunk people made and continue to make. And he joined the Navy in World War II. That got him over to Europe, where he toured the museums and decided then and there that's what he wants to do, is become a professional artist. He came back, took advantage of the GI Bill, went to the Colt School of Fine Arts on the Capitol Square in Madison, did some time at the University of Wisconsin at Madison Area Technical College, and, you know, devoted himself to art and then raising a family as well.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I really got to know Harry, or met Harry, I shouldn't say. I never really got to know him well, but through his brother, Wally, who had, he and I shot some trap together and as part of the Hope Rod and Gun Club way back, a long time ago. And a very kind of an unassuming guy to me, to my
mind. Yes. Yeah, he would have been kind of, I think, a little bit amused at all the attention that he's getting here. He definitely would want to be involved in it and, you know, get to work and create a sculpture. Gene knows that.
I would bet that would be the case. How'd you meet Harry, Deb?
I always knew Harry through my family was involved in ice sailing and auto racing. And so I always knew him from that. And Harry's and his first wife, they had seven children, and he ran a auto body shop, you know, and raised seven kids. And his first wife, Marlene, you know, died relatively young of cancer. And so I was living on Lake Higanza at one point, and he would come out, and we'd go ice boating together. And one of my, you know, and so that's, you know, we certainly have a lot, had a lot in common through kind of some, you know, not so traditional things, ice sailing and auto racing and art. So yeah, that's how we met.
I think he tried his hand at a little trap shooting too.
Oh, he did, and I believe he ran a 500 a few times.
Yeah, pretty good, pretty darn good shot for sure. And Gene, before we go to Audrey and Madison, Audrey, hang in there. I just how did you actually meet Harry?
I went when I joined the UW Art Department graduate program. I was really. Sort of tunnel visioned. I wanted to do wood sculpture. That's what I was interested in. And none of the professors there really did that. There was a man that carved wood and made furniture, but that was not quite what I wanted to do. And I made it very clear that I just want to learn how to be a sculptor. And Ho-Chunk artist and professor at the university, Truman Lowe, suggested I go down to Monona and meet Harry. And so at that very day, I went and visited Harry. He took me into his house that day, fed me, gave me something to drink, and we started carving birds together, and we did it for the rest of the winter.
And you were, I mean, sort of together ever since, or, you know.
For a while, we did snow carving together for a few years, actually qualified, competing at an international level. We qualified to be in the Lillehammer Olympics. They were having an experimental snow carving event that we could have participated in, but Harry rejected it because the IOC said you have to represent the United States. And Harry said, well, the Ho-Chunk have always sponsored us. If we can't represent them, we're not going to go.
Yeah.
And I respect that, but I was also sad because how often do you get to go to the Olympics? You know?
Audrey in Madison has something for us. Audrey, thank you for calling.
I just wanted to, Black Hawk Country Club has a heritage of the Ho-Chunk Indians. There are several mounds there, etc. And at one point, they had commissioned Harry to do a sculpture that was hanging in the dining room for years and years. I'm no longer a member of Black Hawk, but I have no idea what happened to it. All I know is that it's not hanging there anymore. But I would hope that they have kept it or that it's someplace. Or given to the right person who would appreciate and enjoy it.
Yeah. Deb, did you?
Yeah, I remember that. I was there for that. Or when he had to refurbish it. I don't believe I was around when he originally did it. But, yeah, they had inquired with us a few times over the years about it. And thank you for the information. I'll have to follow up on that and make sure that's in a safe place.
Oh, Audrey, thank you so much for calling. And by the way, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear your own experiences and some of your own thoughts about Harry's work. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thanks so much for joining in today. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the Harry Whitehorse International Wood Sculpture Festival, June 14th through the 22nd of this year. It's bringing in artists from all over the world to participate in this event. And our guests are Gene Delcourt, who is the founder of the festival. He's also a Madison-based wood sculptor and, of course, Deb Whitehorse, vice president of the festival, and Harry is her late husband. So, questions or comments, again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Gene, what inspired you to create the Harry Whitehorse Festival?
Well, it was at one of the snow carving events we did early on in a place called Frankenmuth, Michigan. There was a team from Denmark that was there, and at the end of the workday, they hung out with us a lot. We became friends. And their captain told us that he was sponsoring a wood sculpture or organizing a wood sculpture festival in Højer, Denmark, which is on the west coast of Denmark. And Harry kind of elbowed me and said, "Gene, this is what you've been looking for. You should apply." So I did apply. And they accepted me, and that sort of started it. And I went to 7 different events over the course of the years, and every time I'd come home, I would tell my wife, "Gosh, I would love to sponsor a wood sculpture festival, but I don't know how." And we went to Germany 2 years ago, and participated in another one, and on the plane ride home, we were talking about it, and my wife said to me, "If we don't do it now, maybe we're never going to do it. So we've got to do it." So I called Deb when I got home and told her I was interested in doing this and what she thought. And she said, "It sounds great. Go for it." She happened to be here at San Damiano, just walking the grounds because they're incredibly beautiful. And she met up with a city councilwoman from Annona named Nancy Moore and mentioned it. And Nancy Moore called me up and we met for coffee. And she and a friend of hers, a retired teacher named Pat Howell, who was part of the Friends of San Damiano, They said, "Oh my God, this sounds great. This could be an annual thing. Could be the biggest thing Monona's ever seen." And so that launched us off, and we started, you know, writing grants and trying to find funding and getting more people involved and interested. The mayor was all about it. We told her about it, and she was very excited about it. And it's just taken off from there.
And you're right about the setting. the setting. Yeah. I couldn't imagine a better place for this festival.
I agree. We had originally thought we would do it at Olbrich Park because Olbrich has a beer garden already in place. And knowing if we bring a lot of European artists, they're going to want to drink beer. And but then we happened to be going by San Damiano during one of their beer gardens fests, bicycles all over the front yard. And I didn't know. I thought it was still private land at that time. So we went in to see what it was, and there was a band playing and people picnicking on the grounds. And as soon as we saw it, we looked at each other, my wife and I, and said, "Oh my God, this is the place. It's got to be here."
Yeah.
There's no nicer place, at least in Dane County, where you can watch the sunset. It's spectacular.
Yeah, it's spectacular. Deb, I want you, well, maybe Gene to chime in too, but talk about Harry's legacy. He's left a huge legacy, and we find it, you know, if somebody comes to this event, they can also travel just around Madison. You wouldn't have to go very far to see some of Harry's work.
Exactly. Harry has, I believe, 10 public sculptures in Madison.
Yeah.
On his website, harrywhitehorse.com, there is a link to a map with all of the sculptures that you can see. Some are inside, some are out. So, yeah, he's, you know, I wonder if there's any other artist that has as many public sculptures as Harry. And he started out, originally he wanted to be a marble carver because that's what he saw in Europe. And after, I think he did one statue and thought, that's too heavy, I can't carry that around to exhibit. And so he kind of developed a way, he made metal sculptures, cutting out pieces of metal, pounding them to the shape like a puzzle, and then welding them together and then grinding the welds. For instance, there's a Vietnam veteran memorial in Fitchburg, Wisconsin, that is made with that process. But eventually, it took a toll on him, his arms, tennis elbow or sculptor's elbow, or whatever you want to call it, pounding all that metal out. So he went back to wood, you know, the wood of his childhood. And that's when, you know, Gene came and they started working on birds together. And I'll have to say, you know, the chickadee was his favorite. He was really inspired by Wisconsin birds. He wasn't real anxious to do birds from, you know, kind of exotic birds. Sometimes people would ask him to carve a bird, a parakeet or something. And he didn't really care for that. He was very, had a real close connection to the birds that we see here.
Well, the muskie that I have that was carved, it is, it's just so exquisite. The fins in that are so beautiful, and the carving of them, it was absolutely stunning in my mind. Not a large thing, you know, it's kind of bird size in a way, but...
Now, I'd like to ask you, Larry, what inspired you to ask him to carve a muskie?
Well, I am a muskie fisherman, and I have caught and released mostly maybe 150 muskies over my lifetime. But I spent a lot of time in the water fishing for muskies. So and I have many, many wood carvings in my home. Probably, I've got a whole room of maybe 40 duck carvings. But
wow.
But my prized possession is that one from Harry. A lot of meaning in that one. A lot of meaning. Carol in De Pere has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm calling representing several groups of vision impaired and blind people, and I'm wondering if a touch tour has ever been thought of, or are the art items too big for that?
I don't know about that. Gene, what do you think?
I imagine there are some sculptures that are very tall that would be difficult to do, but I most of the pieces that I've seen of Harry's could be touched. Most of the pieces that I've done, except for one, are certainly small enough that you could touch it and see it with your hands. I think this is a great idea. I've never promoted anything like that, but you've planted the idea in my mind, Carol, and I think it's a wonderful idea.
You know, the thing I think about a lot of Harry's work, okay, there are some very tall pieces, but within those pieces, there are, you know, there may be a small children or a bird or a smaller things that are very intricate, even though it's a very large piece.
Right.
Yes, he was very detail-minded. It was important to him to get, he called it the attitude of, you know, bird, musky, whatever he was carving.
Yeah. So, Carol, you've planted a seed here, but I would think if, you know, someone with sight issues would certainly benefit from touching and following the lines of that work. Thank
Carol,
you.
Carol, you should probably try to organize a trip down here, perhaps late in the week when the sculptures are done or almost done, and then you could get a sense of what people have made by touching them. That would be really neat.
Yeah. May I ask one more thing? If this year is not workable at the last minute. Is this the same timing each year?
This is the first one, and hopefully there are more to come. Right, Gene?
The hope is to do it every other year. The every year would be nice, but we found this time around many of the artists from other countries struggled to get visas in time. One hasn't even had his appointment to get his visa expedited because his original appointment was 2025 till tomorrow. He'll be seeing at the consulate in Paris tomorrow, and then it's going to take a day or two to get his passport and visa back. But he said he'll come, even if he comes late, he's confident he could get his sculpture done.
And so there, Carol, yes, keep listening. we'll keep you informed, but it's probably going to be an every other year event, which does make a lot of sense. Thank you for calling. Karen in Madison, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say I'm so happy that Harry is going to have this big. I'm right by Obrick Park, and I just love the Indians, and I've got a big wood sculpture that was done by a chainsaw when I lived in Boston, but I also do wood carvings, and I've got a couple, and I just hope I can get down there since I'm right next to Obrick Park and see everything. It's just so beautiful. I hope everybody in the world will come.
That, Karen, thank you so much. Well, I don't know if everybody in the world, but a lot of, we're hoping for a lot of people and expecting quite a few people. There's just to mention, for those who would drive, there's parking at Monona Grove High School. And you can find this on the site, the website, but there's, and then you're going to be busing, although it's, frankly, it's not a long walk from Monona Grove High School to San Damiano. Could either walk down from there or take one of the shuttle buses, right?
It's about
about a quarter mile or?
Yeah, about a third.
About a third of a mile. It's not a long walk.
Yeah, a couple blocks. Yeah.
But there will be some shuttles to take people back and forth. And tickets, it's a free event, right?
It is.
So you can, go ahead.
I think Eventbrite was used just for us to get a sense of what kind of numbers we might expect. So anybody that went on Eventbrite and purchased a ticket, that gives us a count.
That was the reason for it. Well, so you don't really need to purchase a ticket because the event is free. You can just show up. And again, let's go through the timing on this.
Deb, you want to do that?
Sure. Friday evening, tomorrow, the 14th of June, opening ceremony at 5 p.m. You will want a shuttle from MG21 Liberal Arts Charter School or Monona Methodist Church. All that info is on the website. And then the artist will start carving on Saturday. On Tuesday, we have the Cashbox Kings for the San Damiano Beer Garden. On Friday is Make Music Monona. In addition to all the, sculptors that you'll be watching, and we have a lot of programming from the Little Eagle Arts Foundation, Ho-Chunk Artisans creating baskets, beadwork, weaving, and things like that. And then we have closing ceremony will be amazing on Saturday the 22nd, 5 p.m. All the sculptors will explain their works.
I tell you what, it's going to be great, and these sculptors will be sculpting away, and they'll have finished pieces hopefully by the end of the week session. It's been great talking with you both. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We'll have a link, but if you, the Harry Whitehorse International Wood Sculpture Festival, June 14th through the 22nd, we'll have a link on our page. Go to idea, or I'm sorry, WPR.org/Larry, WPR.org/Larry, and go to today's date. But if you type Harry Whitehorse into a search engine, you're going to find it. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us.